The following is an excerpt of an interview with Mark Breck on Different Bits. The archive is available in its entirety on radio.indymedia.org. My guest tonight is Mark Breck, war photographer.
Yes, hello. Welcome to the show.
So, do you want to give us a little background on your work, where you've been and what you do?
I came from experimental filmmaking. I did not study journalism, nor do I think of myself as one. I still make documentary films when I have the time. And I've worked in numerous conflict zones. In the last 10 years, I've did a project on crimes against humanity, or documenting the last genocide in the 20th century and now into the 21st century. So
maybe we should just plunge right into talking about Sudan, since you just came back. And first of all, you want to talk a little bit about what drew you to Sudan, and maybe give the listeners a little bit of background on the situation there.
Okay. Sudan is something I wanted to do on my own, and I found a nonprofit to fund it. And it was just a continuing of what I have been doing since 95. And I think they dubbed it the first genocide of the 21st century. But Sudan is a very complex situation, and but not too complex that it's too broken that you can't fix it. To understand what's happening in Darfur, Western Sudan today, you must understand what's happened in the south of Sudan, Southern Sudan, which is been the longest civil war in Africa, period, for almost 23 years, and about 2 million people have died from this. The situation now in West Darfur started about 2 years ago. The government of Khartoum, the central government of Islamic government and Arab government of Khartoum, started putting pressure on West Darfur when they had an uprise. Now, the people in West Darfur, there's four primary tribes, and this is completely desert. They depend on 2 months of rain alone just to survive. West Darfur alone is the size of Texas or the size of France. You can choose which plate you want. They have been marginalized since 1956, since their independence from British. When they started to demand their rights and demand resources and to demand equal share in the government, they saw how the South Sudanese did this, and they decided that we have to do this in our own hands. This is the only way to take up arms against the government. So the government of Khartoum, first of all, hired the Janjaweed, which are Arab descent nomadic peoples. And they knew they can hide behind them, and they spun it at first as these tribes. It's a tribal thing. These nomadic Arabs are coming down from the far north looking for pastures in the desert to graze their livestock and for watering wells, which are short supply. But in the reality, they were systematically pushing the Sudanese, African, the black Sudanese, off their land. The SLA started, the Sudanese Liberation Army started in 2003. They were a real people's movement. I was with them for a month. It was the only way into Darfur and the only way to get a real kind of tour without the government. I was there illegally. I went through Chad. And it was very clear when I arrived that this is something the Khartoum government, Sudanese government, does not want you to know. The evidence is all around. There is numerous villages burned out, numerous bombs that have not detonated but are stuck in the ground in these villages. These people are shepherds. These people are farmers. They tried to use the propaganda, the government, that they're bombing the villages because the SLA stay in them, which is false. Every night we stayed at least 1 kilometer outside the village, slept under the stars. Mm-hmm. The Sudanese Liberation Army got very strong, and the Janjaweed weren't able to defeat them, and so the government themselves had to step in. And they kind of do a two-ply attack on these villages in West Darfur. First, they would bomb from the air. The villagers would run outside the village, and the Janjaweed would be waiting there to shoot them, rape them, or capture them. Or they would ride in on their horseback or camels, and they would burn their huts and so forth. Now, this took place for a good 2 years. From this systematic campaign by the Sudanese government, you have over 200,000 refugees who have made it into Chad. And within Darfur itself, you have 1.8 million people who are displaced, or they call IDPs, internally displaced in their own country. They are too afraid to go back to their villages. They live under the trees. They have built makeshift homes, and this is where they stay. Now, the Sudanese Liberation Army controls 80% of Darfur. Only 20%, the big cities, are controlled by the government. Within these cities is El Fasher, which is the capital of North Darfur. You have El Jina, which is the capital of West. And then in the south, you have Nila. Now, there is government-controlled refugee camps in these places that are absolutely just wretched and horrible. And some of the images you see are from these. And the IDPs that are controlled in SLA territory are much better. They get much better aid. And the refugees that are in the government-controlled areas, they have now hired the Janjaweed. Basically, the ones who put them there are now the ones who are guarding them, and they're in the camps, and they're like prisons. See, Chad and Sudan, there was never a line except the colonizers, the British, drew that line. They come from the same tribes. Mm. They speak the same language. Now, the language in Chad is French, and in Sudan is Arabic. But when they started to come across the border in the early stages, of course, there was no UN set up there. And the local Chadadians took them in and gave them, they have nothing themselves, and they gave what food and water they could support until the NGOs showed up. This actually caused a lot of problems in the eastern part of Chad, because then all the NGOs came. They came with all their funding, all their trucks and everything, and they took care of these refugees, and the local Chadadians don't even have the basics. So they made a deal with the government of Chad that they will support the schools and support well digging when they were in there. And So after working in Chad, I knew I could find an SLA representative in Bahai, or some of the young men come into the camps to visit their families and then return to Darfur. And it was there I met logistics for the SLA. And he punched in a number in his Theraya, which is a satellite phone, and handed it to me, and on the other end was a man named Suleiman Jamous, already in Darfur. Suleiman is a humanitarian affairs coordinator for the SLA. He is a civilian. He does not carry a weapon. And he told me I would have to get into a truck on the border. They would pick me up, a unit, which they did, and then they drove me down to where he was camped. So,
what was your first impression, like your first night with them?
Well, I should say it was geographically it was most challenging place I've ever worked, the most hardest conditions I've ever been in. There's no roads, there's nothing. You know, size of Texas, no roads, no electricity. It's just rugged desert. And I've been on the farthest edge of Tibet and other places, but I've never felt more that I was not on planet Earth, to be honest. You feel like it's just this abandoned moon kind of atmosphere. And since there's no electricity, there's no light pollution. So the stars and the moon is has never shined brighter. And we slept underneath the stars every night on rugs with blankets. You know, it's like going back 2,000 years, minus the Land Rovers and the RPGs and the machine guns and the modern weaponry. It's very similar. My first night with them, they're older than people expect. They're not rebels. What I found out is a real people's movement started from the civilian population of Darfur itself. All the commanders are college educated or higher. They've all perceivably gave up a comfortable life in Khartoum or other cities to leave their profession and to fight for what is rightful there is in West Darfur or Sudan itself. And I knew I've been around enough rebels, and I was with the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, and the Balkans, and I was with the army in Rwanda, and you could tell right away they did not come from military, meaning that they were not a splinter group from the Sudanese military. They had no military background, and there was that energy there. They were civilians, for sure, but they were very organized and very educated. And you felt comfortable right away with them. And so first night I stayed overnight, and it took 2 days just to get to Suleiman. And then when I reached him, there was a huge meeting that just by coincidence with all the SLA commanders. And when I met Suleiman, I realized he's probably the wisest man I will meet in my lifetime. They just don't make people like him anymore. He's 57 years old. He was arrested 4 times since 2000 by the government when he was in Khartoum. Each time they could not prove he was helping the SLA from his home in Khartoum. One time he was jailed for 22 months, and then after that release, he realized it was no longer safe. They were just going to kill him instead of jail him. So he snuck out of Khartoum, went to Al Fasher, and snuck into the rugged desert of West Darfur by camo, and has been with the SLA for 2 years now. So.